Hey folks, David here. As you'll no doubt notice, our special guest's audio in the first segment leading up to the rundown sounds about on par with a NPR reporter out in the field. This is just a technical error. We couldn't avoid it in this instance, but that only lasts up to the rundown. Everything from the rundown on will be sound nice and crisp as you're used to here. So apologies in advance, and thank you for tuning in here, folks. And welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that would just like to say it took Charlize Theron a few tries, but she eventually got herself an action franchise. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir. And, yep, it's going to be a good one because we have a guest in the booth. Who do we have with us tonight?
Eric Jones. I think this guy was about to be like my fourth or fifth time joining you guys. Been with you guys for Conan the Barbarian, Full Metal Jacket, most recently Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within.
And one of the Planet of the Apes movies, yeah. If I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Sadly, this episode does not. Oh, man. What was the guy's name? He was the sheriff on Columbo, Lou. Anywho, on that promising start, Dave, what is this show and what are we talking about this episode?
Why, this is Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every week we take a look at a film, we throw it under the microscope, look at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, spoil the ever-loving hell out of it. The important thing is that each and every film we take a look at must somehow connect back to the film we discussed upon the preceding episode. And Andrew, what were we taking a look at last time on this little program of ours?
Last time we were looking at the movie She's So Lovely, which we disagreed pretty strongly on, and the more I think about that yep. movie, the more I actively hate it. So what better thing to do than to follow the costume designer, I had it here, Beatrix Aruna Pazler, a little bit forward into the future to 2005. Tonight we are looking at Aeon Flux, directed by Karen Kusama, with a cast featuring Charlize Theron and a whole bunch of people I've never heard of other than Johnny Lee Miller and Pete Postlethwaite. Oh yeah, and Frances McDormand, Oscar winner Frances McDormand. We are looking at the live action adaptation that wasn't of Peter Chung's deeply influential series for children of the 1990s.
Well, the good news for me is, and the bad news for both of you, is that this is another episode where we get to play the game of guess who guest starred on Doctor Who in the years surrounding this film. So
it's got Doctor Who for Dave, and it's got a buy-in for comic book fans. So why did this movie so dramatically underperform? It is... I think before we dive into it, I think it very much can be said to be certainly in the vein of contemporaneous future action thrillers, but there's something just sort of off about it.
Well, I mean, it certainly is a film that its reputation has not exactly gone down terribly well in the years since. I gotta say, Eric, did you see this thing back when it was originally released in 2005?
Not see it in theaters. I did when it came out on DVD. I bought the DVD when it came out because when I was just learning about it, and then I, like, right before the DVD came out, they had re-released the animated program on DVD, and I had rented that from Netflix, and became familiar with the, you know, with the thing and the concepts. I think it also came, there was kind of a little push of Peter Chung at that time, because I think they might have been preparing for the Animatrix. Those shorts, or those might have been in production at the time.
Oh yeah, the Animatrix.
So I think that was why they gave a little push, definitely a little push. Well, one, because of the movie itself, but I think they wanted to, you know, get a little Peter Chung exposure out there. So that was my, that was how I came familiar with the film and the property as a whole.
I'm going to go on a limb here and say that Eric's experience was probably not common to many, certainly in a numbers sense. Eon Flux, I think, is rightly remembered as underperforming, but in a lot of ways, it really does not make the cultural impact that the original series does. And I think it's also important to realize we're kind of talking about cult material. A lot of people probably don't remember the series Eon Flux, let alone this movie. So we're going to have Dave do what he does best, bring us all up to speed, and he's going to give us The Rundown.
Eon Flux is director Karen Kusama's 2005 adaptation of the famed animated series created by Peter Chung. Charlize Theron stars in the role of Eon, a rebel spy in a future dystopia who stumbles upon a larger mystery when attempting to complete an assassination mission. Despite being made on a relatively modest budget, Eon Flux would end up being a critical and commercial disaster upon release, with the film being more famous for the behind-the-scenes production troubles. Coming up after film strips, an episode of the short-lived spinoff of both The X-Files and The Simpsons, Skinner and Skinner.
So, before the show we were talking, and for once it's an area that David doesn't have an expert level of expertise. But when we talk about Eon Flux, most people don't think about the movie. They think about the series created and largely associated with MTV's Liquid Television that was created by Peter Chung, who, among other things, worked for Disney, worked for Ralph Bakshi, and also did character design for Rugrats. Animation is an interesting place, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would say that's safe to say. And if you have, and if you work for Ralph Bakshi and you come out the other end able to get anything made, I salute you. That seems not to be a hard taskmaster and somebody whose mentorship may not always necessarily lead to the best results.
Yeah, and especially the interesting thing about Peter Chung, though, is especially in Eon Flux, you show that while Chung can make a very commercial type work, when Chung is left to his own devices to explore philosophy and use a very minimalist, non-continuous form of narrative world building, it goes to interesting places. But I guess the first thing to note, though, is that it's not quite as simple as Eon Flux ran for a bunch of episodes and then they made a movie adapted. Instead, it sort of exists as three distinct seasons, but each one is very different in terms of form than the others. So, David, you have seen the pilot. How would you describe that as a narrative work?
It is effectively a silent film. I mean, there's a soundtrack to it, but this is not a dialogue-driven thing. And my understanding is, I guess, that for the first two seasons of the show, in as much as they count as traditional seasons, that's pretty much the case. And it's a fairly straightforward narrative in terms of what the story is, but the actual execution is what I would say heavy metal, the 80s film was aiming to do, and from my perspective, doesn't succeed at. But
it did give us the voice cast from SCTV. But yeah, so Eric, as somebody, because the pilot and the second season, which is, I believe, five shorter episodes around 2 minutes in length, like, what do you remember, like, the themes of those being?
I always think of them more as just, it's a very unique world that they have, but there, I don't think there's a whole lot of, like, I guess, world building in it.
Well, yeah, because it's entirely silent, right? And famously, in each of, both in the pilot and in each of the shorts, an interesting thing happens to the character you're presumably building a franchise around. Eon Flux dies in each of them.
Yep, for that first pilot season and then the second season, yep, in every in every episode, Eon does die, and it's usually, I guess what's kind of interesting about it is they're not usually, it's not some big dramatic, well, you probably can't really do it because of the length of them anyway, but then it's not like a very dramatic death. It's usually something really simple that results in her doom.
Yeah. It's neither dramatic nor is it a heroic death.
Yes.
It's just a very casual snuff out.
She'll like slip on, she'll like step on a thumbtack, and when she's holding her foot will fall over the edge, or something like that. Or she got all the way to the, she got all the way to the end of some laser maze only for the one little poisonous bug or something like that to hit her exposed skin or something like that. It's all sorts of, it's just, it's so random, and I think I guess that what kind of adds to the uniqueness of the series.
Well, yeah, and despite the fact that it's a very, very stylized aesthetic, Peter Chung very consciously is imitated by what's his name? Emil, Egon Schiele, the German artist. There's a very expressionistic aspect to the visual look of the series. But it's also cool for 1991, right? It's a sleek quasi BDSM aesthetic mixed with a gun battle filled future. But like the central theme of it though is the circularity and pointlessness of conflict as well. And so like it works in telling that story largely visually and thematically. So what do you do on the successful heels of that? You make 10 approximately 30-minute animated episodes that are fully voiced and do have verbal storytelling as well, but it's also making a much more involved piece than the shorts. And yet, at the same time, none of the episodes canonically flow with one another, and Eon still manages to die in at least one of them. But in all of them, I guess if there's a narrative, it's Eon is a woman in the future who is working sometimes with, near, or against the more or less the guy in charge, Chairman Trevor Goodchild.
Yeah, and again, I haven't seen much beyond the pilot, but I mean, you get the sense that the Goodchild, like there are certain things which will be picked up on in the film version when we get to it, such as the idea of sort of a disease, something that is infecting and killing people, in grand schemes, and Goodchild being sort of central to addressing that concern in some way and gaining fame and fortune through that.
Yeah, it goes weird places, and it is definitely a work aimed for a more adult audience, not just because of like titillation, but also it's a deeply philosophical work, and it certainly doesn't play out as standard action fare. Like, I think there's this tendency, similar to something like Ghost in the Shell, where people remember it as being like John Woo's Hard Boiled, and it's really not. It's a much like slower and more deliberate piece. And this movie, when it does come out, a full decade after season 3 of the series did, I guess when you're making a movie, you have to narrow your approach. And I don't think you can make something that is as deeply deconstructive or self-consciously like subaltern as Aeon Flux is in animated form.
Well, I'll toss this question to you, Eric, and I'll see what you think here. I mean, given you that you're way more familiar with the source material than I am, but I do have the question based on everything I'm hearing. Can you actually make a film itself? Like, and would you say that there is something suitable for making a blockbuster film out of as a feature film, based on that animated series?
Man, I was wondering this as I was watching it. Sometimes I would think you could with sometimes you'll see people really kind of want more sort of, I guess, deeper or any sort of more esoteric views in their blockbusters, but at the same time I've seen what happens when that when the few rare cases where that does happen, or if someone tries to do that, and it usually it doesn't go over, it doesn't go over too well. If the source material was a bigger thing, and I know it was a thing, but if it was a like if it was a bigger thing, I guess something that's close that I can think of, I don't know.
Like, it's not Star
Right,
Wars, right? I mean,
it
I think you have to be a certain kind of audience member of a certain kind of age to be drawn to something like Aeon Flux in the first place.
yes. Actually, it kind of makes me think about like our discussion on Final Fantasy and how that was a property you thought, and I'll say I'll definitely go and be 100% certain that Final Fantasy is a bigger property than Aeon Flux, but that was a property that you thought you had something sure, and then it turns out you didn't. So for this, I'm not sure. The movie has to draw people to would have had to draw people to the show. I don't the show wasn't going to draw people to the movie, if that makes sense.
I think that's a very apt framing of it, especially with this film, because I guess all that to allude to is, I guess when you say you're going to make a film based on Aeon Flux, this is a film that gives you the same visuals without the same kind of visual storytelling, I guess. You end up getting something that looks very accurate to Peter Jung's animated world, except it has none of the same kinds of thematic or philosophical engagement. And there's nothing very deconstructive about that. Now, that doesn't mean it can't be fun and it can't be good, but like the animatrix, again, not a hugely successful animated work, but I mean, certainly something that is kind of fondly beloved and appreciated by many. That comes out, and I feel like this movie would have worked so much better if it was animated. But then you also look at something like Minority Report, which I think is 2004, 2005.
Yeah, it's around there.
Yeah, and I mean, that one hits big, and in some ways, I think it defines the aesthetic and sort of narrative template that a lot of sci-fi future action becomes defined by for a while, namely yellow reflective surfaces and blue filtered lighting.
See, and you can both correct me if I'm completely off the mark on this. Based solely upon watching that pilot episode, I get the feeling that if there was an accurate translation of that animated short into a live action film, we basically have been looking at the Zardoz of the 2000s. Which, I mean, look, as someone who's loves while also recognizing how completely bonkers Zardoz is, I mean, like, I can see the studios taking a look at a script for something like that and saying, there is no way in hell we're financing this here. And but that, I mean, I guess that brings us to the question of why the hell did Aeon Flux even get in a position to be made into a feature film? And you can kind of look at this and say corporate synergy came played a lot into this, because MTV is part of the same overall company that owns Paramount Pictures, in this instance. I think they're all controlled by Viacom, were controlled by Viacom at that point, and I think they're once again all housed under Viacom these days as well.
Viacom, it just, there's something that sounds so generically global corporate about it. It's like World Pictures. I don't know. It's one of those names where you figure they're up to something. In this case, though, it was, I guess, making a movie is based on anything they had the rights to in the storage locker.
Well, I mean, that's basically been Paramount's MO for a long time, because I've said it before and I'll say it again. Franchise management at Paramount is not their strong suit.
When you say it's not Paramount.
Indeed. Like, I mean, basically, if it's not Mission Impossible, they don't know what they're doing. And to be honest, it's when you consider the del how long it takes between Mission Impossible films, like, how many studios would have put up and waited for Tom Cruise as often as they do? But Yeah, I mean, the basic thing is that they at least seem to take this property and they end up turning it over to a noteworthy producer who we should probably acknowledge here, which is Gale Ann Hurd. Now, Gale Ann Hurd, for those of you who are not in the know, is a longtime producer who really gets her start of her career alongside James Cameron, producing the original Alien in this instance, and going on to produce Aliens as well as The Abyss. And since her, the sort of the dissolution of both her professional and personal relationship with James Cameron, has gone on to produce things such as Hulk, The Incredible Hulk, Punisher 2004, Dead Man on Campus, amongst many, many others, and the Walking Dead television franchise.
Okay, not a bad batting average there.
No, not at all. Now, they start turning around to filmmakers to try and bring in, and it seems that they were having a great deal of trouble getting anybody to have a take that the studio was interested in. And if you ultimately believe the person who ended up getting the job, the reason for that is that nobody was actually seeming to take the notion of making a film out of this all that seriously, as they were coming in to pitch it. Nobody really had, this is our take, this is our story, this is what we think the world would look like in this instance. So ultimately, this ends up being the second feature film to be directed by Karen Kusama. Now, to throw to you, Eric, I mean, around this time, had you seen Kusama's first feature film, Girl Fight, from 2000?
I have not.
Okay.
Well, that one definitely certainly earned the reputation of being like the sleeper indie smash. It was kind of like the Winter's Bone of its day, but that one also is kind of the breakout role for Michelle Rodriguez.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It gained a lot of critical traction, but ultimately, I mean, it was one of those films which was bought for $3 million at Sundance as sort of part of the end of the golden age of the sort of 90s Hollywood indie phase, and then didn't quite make that back. And Kasama admits that in the aftermath, she really struggled to try and get a second film off the ground, and really only took pitching for this film with the understanding it's like, well, this will be good training and practice because there's no way in hell I'm getting a job directing something this big. And then she ended up getting the job because, from the sounds of it, she was the only one that actually came in prepared to do the job correctly and actually, look like we're going through the motions to actually get the job itself in this instance.
Well, I think part of that is owing to the fact that it's like you know what a Neon Flux movie is going to look like, but figuring out what that movie is going to be about as a 90-minute narrative is something very different. And, it's one of those things that we'll very quickly tip our hands and say, I don't think this is the direction I would have gone in. At least there is the willingness to come up with something. And again, Neon Flux is a film where choices are made. But I can also recognize the inherent difficulty in doing that because the series is not really a narrative work the way that, say, Blade Runner is.
Well, no, absolutely. So, I mean, full credit to her for trying this, but this also means that she's part of, I think, a trend that, particularly these days, has grown considerably in the years since, which is this idea of taking small indie filmmakers who have their sort of breakthrough work with dealing with something with a very micro budget, and then watching them get tossed into the deep end on these mega budget studio pictures later down the line. So let's take a look at some of the ones that have happened in this instance. So let's just say, are both of you familiar with a little fellow by the name of Colin Trevorrow?
No. We looked at 54, though. That was another case of indie director kind of getting chewed up by the machine, a real life Barton Fink.
Yep, you were jumping in there, Eric?
Yes, I was gonna say I am familiar with Trevorrow, yes.
Yeah, because he gets his break with Safety Not Guaranteed, this quirky little indie film that gains a little bit of critical notice, and then suddenly he's directing Jurassic World as his follow-up in this instance. We end up with someone along the lines like Mark Webb, who I'm trying to remember what his breakthrough film was. It was that one with was it with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, or am I completely misremembering?
No, you're right. 500 Days of Summer.
Thank you. Yes, yeah, it was 500 Days of Summer. Yeah, he breaks through with that, and then suddenly it turns around. It's like, hey, Would you like to take over the Spider-Man franchise and reboot it for us in this instance?
His last name is Webb. It makes perfect sense, David. But that's the only reason.
Uh-huh.
No, it's true. I bet the studio was like, come on, you know he's going to be perfect for
this. I'm sure he's heard...
Read the name.
Yeah, I'm sure he's heard many of these jokes and regrets many things.
It's not a joke. Like, I think that legitimately was the rationale between looking at that work and being like, let's have this guy make Spider-Man.
Fair.
A lot of great work begins as a dare, I'll have you know. But yeah, now there is the article on BuzzFeed that is sort of a bit of an oral history of this movie, and it very much seems that faith is kind of lost, and in this case they didn't fix it in post as much as that's where the trouble began.
Yeah, because Kasama comes in with her pitch. It's accepted by there, and the studio executives at the time running Paramount along with Gale and Hurd apparently are all big on this idea. It's like, yeah, this sounds a little offbeat and weird and different, and, you know, certainly seems to fit with what we're going for. And since they were looking at making this under a reasonably tight budget, this film comes in for somewhere around $53 million in terms of its production budget, which in the mid-2000s is really actually considerably low. Case in point, Daredevil from 2 years prior would cost in the mid-70s for that, and then your real big blockbuster films like Spider-Man, Sam Raimi's original one there, you know, was spending well over $100 million in this instance. So it's a bet from Paramount, but it's not an extremely over-the-top bet either in terms of the resources financially they're putting behind it.
Well, I mean, it kind of falls... Dave, you put in the notes that this feels like a very European action movie.
Yes.
But I think maybe... It sort of hits the same tier as something like Taken, which, again, very European action movie. And it's not necessarily that there's something cheap about it, but you can tell that this film wasn't made with necessarily A-list resources, but also in the fact that people die, but this is a fairly bloodless movie. Things like that, I got distinct, like, Luc Besson produced... that kind of action film vibes from this one.
Well, that's where the things get weird, because, okay, the film goes into production. It's shot mostly over in Germany. Charlize Theron, who at this point is... I'm trying to sort of position this in terms of her career. She's already sort of had her big breakthrough in terms of dramatic acting, and this is sort of the phase where she starts seriously looking to sort of headline...
Well, she won the Oscar for Monster, yeah. And was that 2005?
2002?
Oh, yeah. Wow, even earlier. Oh, man.
Yeah, so, but for her, yeah, this is the point where, yeah, she's accepted as a dramatic actor. Headlining a blockbuster seems to be, like, the next thing on her bucket list to get out of the way in this instance. And she's, you know, this seems to be the word she's willing to go with it. Now, from the sounds of this thing, this film was shot with the intention of it being an R-rated film in some form, which, to be fair, when you take a look at the source material, kind of makes sense.
Like, it's definitely not for kids.
Yeah.
Or families, right? The same way that Jurassic World is.
Well, exactly. So they shoot this film. She starts putting it together with her editors. They turn around and they hand it over to the studio. Except here's something that I don't think we've ever actually covered on the show before. So this makes it first. What happens when the studio executives who you start making the film with are no longer at the studio by the time you get into the production, the time you finish production? Because that happens, and the new studio heads hate the film. These were the people who did not greenlight it, did not like it, wouldn't have spent the money to make it, and now they've got this film where, from their perspective, they need to save it. And Eric, how would you like to say, what was their idea of saving it in this instance, as far as they were concerned?
And I don't know, I couldn't find what they said, like, Kasama's, her original films, her original cut's length was, but they chopped the thing down to 71 minutes.
71 minutes!
Yes, and...
$50 million an entire film later, they say, good news, everyone, we saved it. It is an hour and 10 minutes long.
Yeah, so they were really going for that walking tall to, with the Rock vibe on this one, but...
Sometimes it is time to make a stand.
God, no. Point being here that, yeah, this film was, yeah, the studio then took a look at what their individuals had come up with and realized, oh, God, this is an incomprehensible mess. Maybe let's bring back in the director who we fired to come in and finish the film.
Calling it now, it's Ross is going to post the Simpsons Radioactive Man movie where we'll fix it in the editing.
Well played.
You can see it all on the screen.
Yeah.
Fired. Yeah, so apparently it is disastrous, and the studio knows this, so Kusama gets called in and basically more or less told, can you please help us fix this movie? And what we get is a somewhat focused 90, but it also does feel like a film where it doesn't end up being what maybe it's set out to be.
Well, that's the thing. From the sounds of it, there are large chunks of the film that were ultimately left out from, like, you're right, Eric, I don't think they've given a firm running time. But from the way Kasama's described that, there seems to be at least about a solid half hour of material that was part of the film that was removed. She talks about certain things, as which I'll highlight as we get through them, where, yeah, this film opened up in a very different way from what we had in the finished movie. But yeah, she's basically, yeah, she comes in to help sort of fix it.
Well, maybe on that note, let's talk about the finished movie, because it's we gotta get there before it's 400 years in our future. I think it relies on one thing though to make whatever the original version was, it brings us all up to speed from the get-go with everyone's favorite thing, the opening text crawl.
Yeah, and in this instance, yeah, basically what we're told is that, you know, in the near future, a virus has basically been plaguing mankind in this instance, killing us bit by bit. Remember when this was, you know, science fiction, folks?
I think they say it was 2011.
Yeah.
So close, but no cigar. Yeah, and it ends up killing off, you know, whatever, 99.3% of the world's population.
Yes, but it turns out, though, that salvation's found in the form of Trevor Goodchild, the head of this company, along with his brother, who comes up with a vaccine that will basically stop the disease. Except, in this instance, it ends up inadvertently causing human sterility. Well, okay, putting, for the conspiracy theorist who may be listening, A, this is not the show for you. Please go. It's here. But number two in this poem.
You don't know it's not happening, David. People laughed when they heard about lockdowns. For all we know, this is our reality.
Uh-huh.
Everything seems impossible until it happens.
Right.
But yeah, worth noting here, Martin Zokas plays Trevor Goodchild here. I spent the entire film saying, who is this guy? And I realized I don't think I actually have seen a Martin Zokas film. But he's a, when he is your male lead, you're either trying to launch a young up-and-comer into stardom, or it's a sign that you don't really care about that role.
I'm gonna go with the former in this instance, but the end results.
I'm just saying, like, this is a guy, and I'm, like, looking at it, and I'm like, well, no wonder I don't know who this guy is. Let's see. He played Lord Celeborn in one of the Lord of the Rings movies. He was the uncredited voice of Poggle the Lesser in Star Wars 2, Attack of the Clones. He was Mr. Smith in Kangaroo Jack. And, whoa, where's a good one? He was Jack Bartz in Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. So he's not exactly, say, casting Ben Affleck in Daredevil either.
Well, yes, but although I will say for the record, I will not have you besmirch the good name of Kangaroo Jack on this program.
But all that to say, though, is the film very much, it's called Aeon Flux. The real star of the film, the one to launch, is Charlize Theron. You know, she is, but It's just this weird dynamic because, as written, the film ends up sharing its screen time pretty equally between Eon and Trevor, and there's definitely a star power differential on screen, I think.
Yeah, there is. But before we even get to this, the big thing is we jump ahead 400 years into the future where it turns out that what remains of humanity is living in this sort of domed paradise. And you might sit there and think, okay, we've had the opening text crawl. You know, that's all the information and setup we're going to be given here. And we're going to be slowly introduced to this world and, showing how it works and how it feels. And I'm willing to suspect, willing to bet, that was actually how this movie was structured once upon a time. Eric, what do we actually get instead after this text crawl is completed?
It's a dystopian sort of look, and you have the oh God, I'm trying to remember like the immediate
It's Logan's Run with parkour, you know?
It's a little bit more, I guess it's a very organic type of world. You don't see too much of, most of the time, sci-fi movie in the future, stuff looks very, it's like a mechanical sort of future, but here it's a little bit more organic. Like you have stuff like, I guess, like Venus flytrap plants or grass that actually turns into blades, like razor blades and stuff, or how they commute, like how Eon communicates through like a form of telepathy. It's actually that's actually kind of like one of the few things I kind of noticed that seems like it does carry over a bit from the show.
Well, it also opens with Eon
Oh God,
laying
how'd I
in
forget that?
bed and very deliberately referencing the famous opening to the
How'd I
animated
miss that?
show, which is a fly crawling along a human eye before the lashes close, trapping it. This is one of those things where I'm like, well, you had to have this moment, I guess. Some things, like Reed Richards in Fantastic Four, though, really work a lot better animated than you can do them in real life, and I think this is one of them.
I definitely would agree. When you see that scene, well, when you see the animated scene, when it's she catches it and it make like her eye lashes almost look like a sort of like a Venus flytrap, and it's a strong image, when you see it, and it's what opens the animated show. And like I said, it's a strong image. They did it, but like I said, it just doesn't have that type of effect.
Well, yeah, and it's worth foregrounding this very brief moment at the start of the film, though, because I think it immediately sets the tone of what follows, which is, okay, well, we're trying our best to be faithful to the look of it, but again, it's the difference between an animated close-up and sort of the framing there versus focusing on Charlize Theron's face, an admittedly beautiful one, while a CGI fly pretends to get stuck in her eyelashes. It's what you know, but it's not what you know. Because what follows, though, is we get even more world building, because there's a secret organization, the Monikans, who are conspiring to take down the Good Child regime. And to be fair, that's kind of like the implicit plot across the Fluxiverse in its various works. But it's another thing to have Eon, who is a very cryptic heroine across the various forms, to suddenly have it open with the forceful, emphatic, "We are the Monikans. We yearn for society to be free. We must return to a world where people don't have to worry about being disappeared by the lab coat wearing secret police," and that. It's basically Fallout 4.
Well, and I mean, this is the thing. Like, let's talk about the voiceover for a second, only because, again, the fact that you open up with opening text crawl, and then suddenly we're into this montage that's been cut together with Charlize Theron's voiceover explaining even more details to us. like, it really gives the indication that there was supposed to be a whole opening sequence to this movie that was just gutted and instead has been replaced. Well,
Green Lantern is another film that gives you a big text crawl and gives you voiceover narration. And as we learned with that one, did have a lot of cuts being made to it in production. So I think whenever you get that double whammy of like narrative crutches to start a film, that's a worrisome sign.
Well, it is. But I will say this, to come back to your point, Eric, about the design of this film. The one thing that really struck me right off the bat here is I love the production design and costume design of this film. Like, it looks unique, it looks interesting, and I mean, even that first thing, that dress that Charlize Theron's Eon is wearing as she's coming down, which apparently was supposed to be a funeral dress, which again, we'll get to, I probably know whose funeral it was supposed to be in this instance that she was coming from. Like, it just looks, it has far more in common with things like Barbarella and Danger Diabolique and The Final Program from 1973 there than anything that we would necessarily see production style-wise from 2000s American blockbuster filmmaking. And yeah, there's even things like when we eventually get to the appearance of Pete Postlewaite in this movie, like, I swear, it's like, did they hire Mobius for like one day just to design stuff for this film?
I mean, it's much more Fifth Element than Sixth Day.
Yeah, exactly there. But yes, it turns out that, yes, thanks to ingesting this chemical there is this telepathy where from the character of the handler played by, yes, a highly overqualified for this role, Frances McDormand.
Yeah, we virtually meet in a nunnery and we calculate political assassination. It's, I mean, the thing is, like, if you're on board with that kind of plot point to just be dropped into a movie, you'll probably be on board with the rest of the film, no problem.
Yeah, and she's basically told, there's a mission, we need you to do this, and carry it out. And the mission itself really isn't all that important, because I don't, again, based on the way this film's structured, I don't even think we ever get a real full understanding of just what it is Eon is actually doing when she's there, other than you're sabotaging the thing, the jacuzzi that has people's memories in it.
Yeah, and across the series, like, the reason why she's sneaking into an enemy compound isn't really the point. The visual thrill is the fact that every time we see her doing a riff on that theme. Whereas, yeah, The ultimate point, though, is that Eon is forced into action. We get to see her work her skills, but she also has a conversation with the one person she's connected to, and that here is Una, her sister, who they meet in a public place. We get the Batman trick of disappearing when a conversation ends. And basically, she cryptically refers to having to go on a mission. The sisters disagree with each other's philosophies, but Eon promises to come home safe and then go to Una's for dinner, because Una has a secret to tell her.
Yes, and as we all know, when you say, I have a secret to tell you later, ultimately, we know where this is heading. And sure enough, in this instance, what does turn out to happen while Eon is finishing up her mission here, Eric?
She, her sister's assassinated because she was mistaken for a mannequin. And then later we find out, not insidious, but we find out the real reason as to why that is. So, we kind of get a little bit of a standard sort of revenge plot. I'm going to have Eon take out the people who took her sister away.
Yeah, because it very much, the first half of the film is sort of somewhat organically building up to Una's death, prompts Eon to agree to take a mission to assassinate Chairman Goodchild himself, while at the same time having the personal interest in avenging her sister.
Yeah, and sure enough, we jump ahead in time to where Eon is being given another mission, this time to straight up murder Trevor Goodchild in this instance. But not before we discover that, yes, Eon's also having weird dreams of memories that don't seem to make sense and look like they were filmed on any given street in 2005 here. So something's going on. But the point is, it's like, yes, go in there, kill Trevor. You know, we'll back you up. This is going to be very important. And sure enough,
Eon... Who are we going to send as your backup to sneak into the place?
Why, that would be Sethandra, played here by Sophie Okonedo, here, who, yes, let's jump into Dave's corner.
You know what else is neato? The fact that she has feet for, or she has hands for feet.
Yeah, exactly. This body modification thing. Now, I do want to take a moment here to appreciate Okonedo's appearance here, because she has the benefit of having appeared in not one, but three episodes of Doctor Who. Scream of the Shulka, the immediate animated prelude leading up to the revival of the show, and as well as playing Liz Ten, the future Queen of England, leading them through space during the 2010 season when Stephen Moffat first took control of the show. I mean,
as one does, yeah. I think by statute, the Queen is obligated to lead spacefaring Britain. You know, stiff upper lip and all that. What a weird series, said the guy who's a big fan of Eon Flux. But yeah, so Sethandra, which again, great future name, her and Eon, they work out the plan to... take advantage of some information they extracted to sneak into Goodchild's compound, doing so by running straight lines through the world's deadliest garden.
Yeah, and I will say, I mean, how does this sequence strike you, Eric, as a sort of action piece of this film?
I actually, considering that right before, you know, before recording here, this was only the second time that I've actually seen the film, but I actually was very impressed. It's a very, I guess the performance of both Okonedo and Theron throughout it. It's a very physical performance. And I think that's actually kind of impressive for this era of filmmaking. You know, they could have very easily, and I'm sure there was probably some, you know, CG involved, but it feels like both of them were actually there. And it was, I won't say it's long, but it was a pretty decent length. I was surprised at how long it was, and I was like, oh, they actually kind of give you a good amount of time here, watching these two women show off their physical prowess in an action scene. I just think it's something that, you know, for that time, that's a very good, just a very good thing to show.
Well, it feels somewhat music video-esque. I disagree with you on a few things, Eric, only because it does feel very cut up, and there are only so many times you can watch somebody jump over the camera from underneath. Over like 2 minutes. It's more so like it is body focused, but it's also a sequence that ends with Charlize Theron doing an impossible split with trapped blades of grass rising up to her throat, right? And I think it sort of tips over by its end into being something that feels more deliberately artificial. So, Dave, to break the tie, what do you think of this scene?
I'm much closer to Eric with this one, where I really do appreciate a combination of factors. So, yeah, I mean, certainly the physicality of Theron and Okonedo in this sequence is incredibly impressive, and apparently they did do the majority of their own stunt work up to the point where legally it was probably advisable not to have them to do so.
You mean we grew all this deadly grass for nothing?
Well, but even the things like the idea of a bioorganic sort of defense system, I love the way that whatever else you can say about this film, it runs with that those ideas. And definitely plays with them quite extensively here in fairly novel ways. And the only thing that holds it back is knowing that ultimately this film had to get cut down to a PG-13. So probably some of the more extreme moments, which would almost veer probably into body horror, didn't end up making it into the film. But having said that as well, the other thing I do appreciate it here is that, yes, while there is some of the gravity-defying physics of it. Ultimately, neither of them is necessarily superhuman. They do take some damage. It's not like the standard trope of, and you flip through the laser security grid with absolutely not touching anything throughout the scene. Like, no, there's a few points where they actually do get a little roughed up during the course of this, even if they do finally make their way through it relatively safely by the end.
Yeah, so they agree that they're going to meet up at the rendezvous. Eon's going to slip in, take care of Good Child, and yeah, then they're going to get out. So Eon gets like a nicely expressionistic sequence. It's maybe the only scene in the film where shadows are projected. Eon going through the tunnels to infiltrate the building. And eventually she comes upon her target, Trevor, who in the in-between, we also see a lot of sequences of like sort of palace intrigue between Trevor, the science council, who is sort of at odds with him, and his younger brother, what's his name? Orn, played by Johnny Lee Miller.
Yes.
Again, who, at this point, Trainspotting, Hackers, there's a certain cachet of films he's been in, but it's also, you know, you need a certain cachet of audience to be like, wow, I've got to go see the next Johnny Lee Miller movie.
I would say, I mean, yeah, Johnny Lee Miller never got quite the breakout that, say, Ewan McGregor got out of that one. In fact, arguably, Johnny Lee Miller got the worst deal out of Trainspotting compared to the rest of that cast. But,
well, yeah, nobody likes Sick Boy.
Well, point being, in this instance, though, that, yeah, he is there, and yeah, we do get the sense that there is this sort of tension within the council. However, I do once again have to highlight one member of the council here, and that is Giro, played here by Patterson Joseph, who, yes, appeared in Christopher Eccleston's final Doctor Who episodes, their Bad Wolf and the Parting of the Ways, and was apparently very close to getting cast as the 11th Doctor before Matt Smith sealed the deal. So,
oh, what might have been.
Indeed. But yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. The point is, though, Eon goes in ready to assassinate him, and then she pauses as she has these fluttering of memory.
And he stops, looks at her, and calls her Catherine. And that was the moment that I rolled my eyes and said, it's gonna be this kind of a story.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess before we move into the next sequence, the scene ends with Eon then getting clonked in the head by, in this instance, Freya, played by Caroline, hopefully I'm pronouncing this correct, Chigetsky? I'm probably botching that horribly there. Please, someone.
I don't think she's listening, if it helps.
Point being here, so at this point, Eric, what would you say about the introduction of this Good Child element with Eon and the idea of him knowing her from somewhere else in this instance?
Like Andrew was alluding to, I immediately, you're just like, oh, okay, yeah, I get where this is going. And then, but it's also interesting because I think when I was reading an article, and I wish I had saved it here. That's what I should have added to the notes, but it was an article written that kind of documented Kusama's journey through this. And like her original plan for the film was supposed to be like this this document of a centuries long love story. And when we find out when a Good Child calls Eon Catherine, we find out that Eon is essentially a clone for everybody. All the citizens are clones. And yeah, so it kind of really telegraphs itself there.
Well, it also immediately frames that, like, through the series, like, Eon and Trevor's relationship and history with each other is never defined strictly, because they're antagonistic, but they are also lovers. And when the series doesn't have an episode-to-episode overall continuity, it very much plays with that. Whereas I think in this moment, it's clear that Trevor is not going to be the villain of the film, and in fact very soon becomes the co-lead as protagonist, because that's further cemented, because Eon's locked in the cell. He has the quick visit with her and basically more or less acquiesces to her escaping. So the whole thing about Trevor is I think you very much anticipate he's going to be the villain. It's not that he's an anti-hero as much as he just becomes the other good guy.
Yeah, and I mean, let's be honest here. Once you introduce Johnny Lee Miller into the film, it was pretty obvious who our villain of this movie was going to be. It was
fair points.
Yeah, Sherlock was away a decade about away for him at this point. So, but yeah,
well, yeah, because it very quickly follows though that Eon escapes, and then we have the council all distraught because they are starting to doubt Goodchild's leadership, especially with the recent escape attempt. And then we find out that Orn is actually the one who hired the monastery assassin contingent to pull off the execution in the first place. So now he's got to cover his tracks, and Eon's got to figure out what's going Eon in the council. Things very quickly come to a head, though. What's the order of events here? Does she find the laboratory and then the council declares a coup?
Well, okay, so a couple things happened. Turns out Trevor left her with another chemical that she could hear in contact with him and hear his thoughts, which leads her to head over to Trevor's home/lab. Again, I understand some people work from home.
It looks like a screen from Myst.
Yeah, it's a little different here. I'm just saying, a separation, clearly defined boundaries in your home. It's a very important thing for keeping your mental health quite well going forward. Yeah.
Plus, you don't see a bathroom anywhere. But we got sort of the tense standoff and the whole... How do you know I won't kill you? All right, then do it. While, jazz saxophone slowly rises up in the background, we end up getting a reconciliation and a night of passionate love.
Yeah, and then she wakes up, investigates the lab, and has a showdown with Freya again in this instance, which, again, you can tell they're cutting around what was probably some very hard R-rated footage in this instance, because you get things like, Eon basically dropping her right onto the valves of what looks like almost a sink in this instance.
Yeah, and that's a prize winning cut right there. But I mean, it also either cuts or does not at all explain one of the coolest things about the film, the weird vest that takes you to an infra space, only because Eon puts it on and finds Trevor's secret lab, which is maybe the most visually stunning shot in the movie. But there's also not any attempt whatsoever to explain what this is, how it works. It's just, oh, here's a magic vest. I'm going to put it on and whoop, look at where I am now.
Well, I guess this does bring to a thing, and I'll throw it to you, Erica, to see your thoughts, because this film, more often than that, does not explain the technology we're seeing. We have to make a lot of inferences to sort of arrive at how things work or what they're doing without sort of clear explanation. And I'm kind of on a 50-50 split about the degree to which this works. I mean, what is your take on it in this instance?
So yeah, most of the time, I kind of don't mind if I don't get as much explanation. I usually just kind of just assume that whatever, however they claim it works, it works. The only reason why I think it's a little weaker for this film is, and I don't know, this may be just because, at least I can't recall, because it's been a while since I watched the show. I don't think they've explained too much in the show. I can't explain it. They don't, but it's, for some reason, it feels like it works, though.
Like, it's not hard sci-fi by any means. And there is something refreshing, because imagine Christopher Nolan making this film, and you get 8 minutes of Morgan Freeman being like, now, when you put the vest on your body, press the button. It will bend light and overly intellectualize it. The problem is, the series, though, everything is on that show-not-tell wavelength, and it works. Whereas here, This is a movie that hits you with two different kinds of opening framing. It is consciously announcing everything that's happening to make its themes clear to the viewer, and then all of a sudden it's like, here's a magic science vest I'm going to put on. And I think there's a bit of a rupture created between them.
That's, I definitely would agree with that. Yes, it's just weird that at that moment, you know, that's the moment when they decide, hey, you know, just go with it. You know, when I watch something like, you know, like Mad Max, we know that when you watch those movies, you know that, the world, you know, went to hell. You don't really know why, but the movie itself does a good enough job of kind of just making you feel part of the world. This one, at that point, it doesn't. It's like, well, you were trying to explain. If they didn't explain anything from the beginning, it probably would have gone over better. Or if they then decided to explain the lab and all that, it probably would have gone better.
Well, it's only just odd because it's such an important plot point.
Yeah.
Because the lab really is kind of the actual key to what the rest of the film ends up being, right?
Well, yeah, because from this point, again, Eon goes on the run again. She basically ends up encountering Sathandra again, and pretty much says, it's like, look, I didn't assassinate him. There's more going on here. We need to start piecing together what's actually happening. Sathandra basically holds her at gunpoint. It's like, look, don't make me do this. But like I said, we just got to complete the mission and we'll get going. And instead, Eon basically ties her up and then leaves her in a pool of water with a single straw to breathe out of. Which on one hand, okay, that's definitely a way to sort of prevent somebody from chasing after you. At the same time, based upon what we see in the movie, how long is she in that water for?
I was wondering that myself.
It appears to be a solid week.
Yeah.
It also doesn't explain why she didn't just stand up.
there are some questions about that as well.
But, I mean, that's sort of Eon Flux kind of in a nutshell, where it benefits from not having a whole lot of explanation behind its set pieces and tends to work more effective when that is the case. But she contacts the matriarch of the Monacan Resistance, who, like, telepathically summons three other people to come and rescue her. So now we have Chairman Goodchild and Eon possibly working together while the science government and the assassin resistance, both parties are after them. It's like Machine Gun McCain, which also just had that inexplicable voiceover.
Now, let's be clear. When the Science Council decides, you know, we got to finally depose Trevor, am I the only one who sits there and thinks, so they basically sat there for an entire while effectively watching the sex tape that was apparently made?
Yeah.
Yep. It's like, you know, like how...
At what point did they start the tape?
Exactly, because we just seem to cut in and it's just like... What is going on here? Like, I mean, somebody is saying, it's like, no, hold on a second. Maybe there's more context to this that will explain things.
Well, yeah, it's like, I mean, it's also part of Orin's scheme, so I don't think he would show the part where they're actually telling each other, here's what's going on in terms of plot mechanics.
Exactly, but...
It's like, we're just gonna skip past the boring parts and look what they're doing. But, yeah, so... Trevor is deposed, Orin, it breaks his heart, but he just has to assume power and lead the council. And I mean, there's also this big flying dirigible that is telegraphed in the opening 30 seconds of the film and you forget about for a while. Eon sneaks onto it, though, and somehow understands how to work this thing, which is hosted by Pete Postlethwaite wearing the eye surgeon from Blade Runner's outfit, and realizes it's a bank of DNA amongst the citizenry, and she, I guess, infers that her sister's DNA has been placed into a new body. She goes to visit at the same time Trevor does, where she discovers an infant child who who happens to have her sister Una's eyes and DNA. And that's when we learn what the dreams are about and everything. And here's where the film gets weirdly conservative in a certain respect.
Well, okay, because, yeah, it turns out that, yes, basically, yeah, Trevor realized that his cure inadvertently created sterility. So he's basically spent the last 400 years through various clones of himself to try and, you know, find a way to correct it by effectively recloning the populace and basically spreading them out to new parents to be raised again and again and again until they can come up with a solution.
Yeah, like, he's apparently the seventh iteration of Trevor Goodchild. And society sustains itself by re-implanting the DNA of the people who, I guess, were previously alive until a cure for sterility can be found.
Yeah, and it turns out, you know, I mean, Eon, now, and apparently, yes, this means that memories apparently can transfer, which, again, I'm not really sure DNA and memory work that way in humankind, but okay, I'll go with it in this instance.
I mean, it's no worse than warm hearts being like, when you eat someone's brain, you inherit their memories. You know, it's pretty hokey, though. But the bigger mystery is, well, what happened to Catherine? And why was Una killed? And it turns out it's all kind of related, because one test group of clones that Una belonged to were experimented on in such a way that it turns out they were not sterile after all. And the thing is, it's just the way they talk about it. There's very much this emphasis that sterility is the worst thing that could possibly happen. Certainly in a global level, yeah, that's the end of everything. But even Trevor, like, comes into conflict with Orin, and they emphasize, like, we have to return to the natural state of things. And it's like, I don't know, it's a weirdly emphatic, heteronormative victory at the heart of this narrative. And it's also just, it's very hard to hear that and not think of people with the license plates that are like, life is precious, from birth to natural death. And, like, the philosophy of this film from that reveal onwards is just, no, we have to return to nature.
Well, we're going to go McLaughlin group here. Eric, your take on things.
I would certainly agree with those sentiments as well. It's very, like I said, it feels, the buildup to this big reveal feels very weird, and actually does feel kind of in line with the show, but then when you get there, when it's revealed directly, and then you're just like, and then it's like, oh, well, this just feels very sort of standard. And that's when you then see Orin kind of just feel like this is actually where I'm kind of confused here, or at least of how the movie kind of frames them. So Trevor is trying to cure the sterility, you know, to get back to the natural things. But Orin is the one that's killing the subjects that appear to have gotten pregnant,
which somehow Trevor doesn't know about, the guy running the experiment.
Yeah, so and so this was actually a moment where it kind of got me. I was like, are you trying to create, like, I know in the show Trevor's very ambiguous with when it comes to everything. He's a lot of things and sort of like nothing at the same time. Like I think you said, Andrew, he's not necessarily anti-hero, not necessarily anti-villain either, but
it's like he's not an opposing force as much as he's just another force.
Yes.
Within the series universe, whereas here he very much gets framed as one of the good guys.
Yeah, and I think, and I thought this moment was kind of weird because, like you said, Andrew, it's a very conservative view, and I don't know, I was like, and I almost wonder, well, at this point, were they trying to bring some of that ambiguity back to Trip? Was that a hope, was that a goal that they were hoping that once you saw what the brothers' conflict was that going to inspire, I guess, some discussion amongst the audience? I don't know if that was the intention.
Well, I think it's more a signal that underneath all of its trappings, though, this is a film that's narrative goal is just romantic completion. And I don't think that's what anybody wants or expects from Aeon Flux. But Dave, as someone who is not, I guess, as jaded by the series, what do you make of this being sort of the narrative problem at the heart of the film, the mass targeted extermination of pregnant women.
Well, I mean, I think there is a lot of potential for a sort of feminist reading of this material. And I think from everything Kasama has said and what I think the intention was with the filmmakers all in here, probably in original version before the studio went to hell on it, probably was played with a bit more nuance where, yes, it's about returning to the natural state of things, not because it was that's the correct thing, but so much more as, we have to step back. We can't keep doing this in the long run because we're just going to destroy ourselves, with the sort of copy of a copy of a copy syndrome that's at risk here. But the actual execution of it in the movie, though, it's far more reductive in what we get. And because of how ultimately, Oren is going to slip into fairly generic villain mode as this thing here. I mean, that's really where it becomes like, even if they were trying, as you're saying, Eric, to add nuance to Trevor, Oren is so blatantly listed as the bad guy. And it's like, can't you see? I needed to murder these people. We have a perfectly working system, and I don't see what's wrong with that. I mean, he really is just one stage removed from being like a Saturday Night Live sketch character in this instance, or.
Well, yeah. And I mean, we also get that same type of storytelling where things come to a head and all parties converge in a wide open field. And then Oren basically spills all of his intentions and further admits that women were fertile again even without the help of your experiment. So I guess his plan was to just murder all women or something like that going forward. But yeah, we've discovered that the planet has healed itself. But we also have everybody pointing guns at each other, and we get probably the big action set piece of the film, which is gun ballet in an open air field.
Along with, yes, Sathandra and her crew there, basically having to make the decision. It's like, do I take the shot or do I not take the shot? Like, literally, we are missing Frances McDormand. They're just shouting into a microphone or into a walkie-talkie. The entire.
Take the shot.
Exactly. So.
Yeah, and most people end up fatally or simply grievously wounded. Sathandra and the other Monikans die nobly. Trevor gets shot, Oren gets shot, and basically everybody else that didn't get a name is shot to death. And I do note that this is a gunfight sequence, seeing as all the other ones are very much like hand to hand or sort of the neck snap, whereas here, no, people get shot and blown up. I mean, it works largely, but then what even happens? She gets back on the dirigible somehow because she's gonna blow that up, and oh right, because she's like. Trevor is being like, well, my lab notes got burned up. I don't think I can replicate my results. And she's like, don't worry, you'll find a way. It's like how they say Columbus burned his boats when they hit the New World. No, that was Cortez. Never
Yeah,
mind.
point B here, that one, what ends up happening is, yeah, she goes up there and has a discussion with Keeper, with Pete Postlethwaite, delivering far above the paycheck he probably received for this movie.
I have in the notes, I'm glad this is not his last film appearance.
No, he deserved way better than this. But I mean, his big thing is he starts explaining to her, it's like, yes, I've been waiting for all of this to come down. And he explains how it is that her DNA survived, even though Oren tried to prevent it here. And I love the explanation.
The flashback.
Yeah. Well, what I love about this is like there's two elements of this flashback I love. It's like, how did Orn try and dispose of your DNA? And it really just comes down to get rid of it and then walks off and just trusts that.
Don't take a DNA sample. And then we get young Pete Posleway with hair just looking sadly off into the distance. And it's like, and that's when I took your DNA.
Exactly. It's like, you think it's like, there was subterfuge or something, right? That was what it was. Nope. He left the room.
Yeah, this is just a man being told, do this, and him saying, don't wanna. And this is the deus at the heart of the film.
Yeah. The...
Because we also find out she is Catherine's clone, but she is the only clone of Catherine there's been in 400 years.
And I love where he delivers, like, I knew I had to save you. We needed your strength. And it's like, really? Did we?
Yeah. You're a woman who died of a disease. I don't think you were terribly strong at the end.
Like, I mean, but it's just sort of, it's like, you know, I'm pretty sure she was not the sole individual. Like, revolutions are not built around a single focal point here, folks.
Well, it's the chosen one fallacy, right?
Yeah.
It's like, Pete Postlewaite is literally doing that. And of all of my children, you are the favorite. Please go ahead and detonate these explosives.
Well, I
want to die.
But that's what I love about this. It's like, first of all, I can't tell. He seems to be a hologram at this point, as best I can tell. Like, I don't think he is alive. Never explain. And not to mention, I love the fact that his fashion sense when alive was suit and tie and just, you know, little sort of, well, what do you call him? Smock or whatever he is. And now it's like, no, I gotta get fancy. I'm a hologram now. I don't feel the burdens of an overly elaborate costume. But two, it's just like, you know, if we jump back about 20 minutes into the film ago, if you had told Eon all of this earlier on, a lot of death could have been avoided up to this point. I'm just saying.
Yeah, but then we'd have a 70-minute cut of the film.
But probably one that would still be comprehensible, unlike the other 71-minute version of this film that apparently existed.
Solid point. But yeah, so then she blows up the thing with everyone's DNA, and it turns out they don't need to do research because people are having babies again. Hooray.
And she crashes the dirigible into the wall, thus allowing everybody to leave there, thus making this, the second Charlize Theron film in which the bringing down of a wall is significant in this instance. So,
yeah, though the other one at least closed on a high note of James McAvoy's speech. We also had John Goodman in that one. And I'm gonna surmise that even if John Goodman was in Eon Flux, it probably wouldn't have worked better. I think the way the film ends is on a very generic note of, it's time to seize the reins of our own destiny. And it's very much like optimistic, onwards to the future type storytelling. And it's fine if that's the case. I think this is a film, though, where the association with Eon Flux is invariably going to make it disappointing, only because, like, if this was an independent script, like, the exact same dialogue, same story and everything, and it was called something other than Eon Flux, I think it would be less irritating.
That's fair. What do you think, Eric?
I think I would agree with that as well.
Only because you can accuse the series of being a lot of things. Conventional is not one of them, whereas the film ends up resolving itself like in the most conventional of its time manner you can imagine. And I think we all kind of agreed that when there's the Catherine moment, you kind of predict about 90% of where the story's going from there.
Yeah, I couldn't disagree there. You know, one thing about this, I don't want to say that the show is bleak. Well, no, I don't want to say it's bleak. It does have some nihilistic moments and tendencies, yeah. But it does.
Every time Eon dies, right?
Yes. And also how it also kind of seeks to explain, well, or show sometimes just like the futility of conflict. And I think that's a very, I think that's an important lesson that it can show. Whereas the film, we have, we just have a typical film Hollywood narrative. The evil's, evil's defeated, and people are, people are free. I, like you said, Andrew, if it was a, if this was an original script from like a first time writer, and this was like their original creation, it probably would have gone over well. But even with the people who have seen the series before the film, you when you get that, you're just gonna be like, yeah, that's you've called the film Aeon Flux, that, but this resolution, that's not an Aeon Flux resolution.
Well, yeah. Dave, now as someone who is less familiar with the series, how do you feel about the story you're presented with by the time we get to the end?
The thing about it is this, is that I wasn't bothered in the sense of feeling any sort of betrayal of the source material, but it's also very generic. And the thing is I will say this though. The first time I watched this film, I hated it. Like, I really, really, really did not like it. I was just down on everything. Watching it through this time though, and again, maybe this is just my old man heart thawing just a little bit each and every day I go on. I actually, as a generic blockbuster film, I enjoyed it far more than I was anticipating this time round. It was, I mean, it's not great. And I mean, and yes, the narrative is nothing special. But if you put that aside and you focus strictly on the formal elements, and particularly that, again, that production design and that costume design aesthetics of the film, there's a lot to appreciate in those components of the movie, because this doesn't look like a conventional blockbuster film of the mid-2000s. And there's something I really appreciate about how honestly colorful a lot of this movie is, because whatever else you can say about it, it doesn't hide from playing around with color in a way, in even bright, vivid color, in the same way that we see with more contemporary blockbusters of that era, or blockbusters of that era, and even ones being made today, where so many of them are afraid of willing to just embrace and say, yeah, no, we can be big and pop and flashy in this way. So is that a superficial enjoyment of the film? Absolutely. But I also would be lying if I said I didn't enjoy those aspects of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's inoffensive enough. It's kind of weird, but not in the way that the series was weird, in a way that prompts deeper inquiry. I think this is, unfortunately, like just as many of its contemporaries, I think it's like a fine if it's on kind of movie. But I don't think it's also the kind of film that will ever, as a film, it will never prompt you to suddenly have an afternoon where you're thinking about, oh yeah, wasn't there that really weird episode where like she keeps being reincarnated in a tunnel and there's a monster baby? What about the one where that guy gives birth to a god? This film doesn't actually have any of those moments. You have something that's visually faithful and visually interesting enough, but that's not enough to make for an interesting film, I guess. That being said, the good thing about visual-centric action thrillers is that narrative is sometimes completely beside the point, and maybe the things worthy of celebration lie elsewhere. And maybe to pull Aeon Flux out of a nosedive, we can turn to Hits and Pits and focus on the positive things, because I know I've been pretty down on it. So, Eric, as our guest, why don't you go first and give us your first hit for Aeon Flux?
My first hit is going to be probably just an obvious one. Charlize Theron as Aeon. This, like I said, I think this is probably her first major action type role, and I don't think there's much as far as dialogue that defines the performance, but it's a very physical performance, as I was talking about earlier with that one scene with her and Sathandra. But I just thought that it was very impressive. And as we get into later in her career with, Mad Max Fury Road, Atomic Blonde, we see that she is proven to be a very capable actor in regards to the action genre.
Yeah, and eventually she would at least get her other time, centuries traveling sci-fi action movie in the form of The Old Guard last year. So, I mean, it took a while, but she got there. 15 years, there are worse ways to wait in that instance. What about you, Andrew? What do you have? I know this might be a struggle for you, but are there any positive things you can throw out for this one?
I think this is. I am going to give my first hit to production designer Andrew McAlpine, because even though this film certainly doesn't have the budget of some, it's at least a cohesive enough world. I think the editing and certainly the production stories of how this film comes to be what it is, that's not enough to overwhelm the fact that overall it's a good-looking version of the future. The film uses color accents pretty well, and it is striking, not just in terms of like the lighting of scenes, but just what they did in terms of building that world. It's less generic than maybe the narrative is. So, thumbs up, McAlpine. You get my first one. Dave, what about you?
I'm actually going to give it to a small moment at the end with Patterson Joseph's Giro talking to Trevor Goodchild after his brother's dead, where he shows up and Trevor's immediate response is, Giro basically tells him, it's like, so what are your orders, Chancellor? It's like, well, you're not in on this? He goes, no, whatever else you may think we are, we're not anarchists in this instance. And it's like, okay.
Well, you see, that's what I mean about the latent conservatism. Not with a capital C, but it's just the idea where in the future there needs to be nature and there needs to be rules.
Yeah, I'm not saying, like I said, I'm not saying that I like necessarily the attitude put forth, but I do enjoy the line where it's like, yeah, you might have thought I was part of this, but the point of the matter is, I still respect some degree of authority. That's, and again, it's just a very clear statement of his worldview in this instance here. Plus, I just really love how Patterson Joseph just tosses off that line in that moment. It's like, yeah, I know there's a lot of death around me, but what do you expect? There. So in that note instance, I do kind of dig that small line. Plus, Patterson Joseph is one of those actors who really just deserves a better break than he's received over time. So
Yeah, he's pretty fine here, despite having not much to do.
yeah, so I do want to give him his big shout out here. What about you, Eric? Do you happen to have a second hit for this one?
My second hit would be actually that the film brought in a pretty, I guess I'll say, pretty decent video game adaptation for the PlayStation 2. Most of the time during, especially during that era, you'd have a movie and they'd have a video game adaptation of it, and most of them aren't worth a thing, worth a dime anymore, anyway. But the Aeon Flux game was actually not too bad, and they actually was able to use Charlize Theron as Aeon for the game, which is not a common thing that they would do back in those days. So kudos for being able to feel you had enough leverage with the film that you could make a game and get the star for
All right. Ancillary marketing, everybody's
it.
best friend. I think my second hit has got to be that flashback sequence and Solemn Pete Postlethwaite. Dave, do you have a second hit for Aeon Flux?
Beatrix Aruna Pazdor, her costume design, I really love it. I've been praising it all episode long, but she deserves the credit for doing something unique. And yeah, even some of the dresses and the other things that they give Charlize Theron to wear throughout this film are striking and visually interesting to look at there. So I do salute that, because again, I really do like these sort of, off-kilter designer futures here for, as an aesthetic approach, and this one delivers on that. But with that, that does bring us to the pits here. Eric, anything in particular we haven't dunked on fairly hard in this one that you want to shout out to?
As a pit, well, not one that we haven't dug though. My one pit is one that y'all probably have talked about already. Johnny Lee Miller as Oren. Actually, not even really any, not even any reason related to the film, other than when I popped in the DVD and saw him, the first thing I immediately recognized him from was he's the main antagonist, spoilers if for people who don't watch Dexter, but he was the main antagonist for the fifth season of Dexter, which I kind of hold against him because season 5 was a disappointment after the great season that was season 4. So it's not even related to the film, and it actually has nothing to do with him at all. But when I saw him in the film, I immediately recognized him as from that, and I was like, well, you know what? I'm just holding Dexter season 5 against you.
Yeah, the film's got to earn it from here. Yeah, you know, that's fair. In many ways, this is the Dexter season 5 treatment of Peter Chung's source material. I think I am going to put a lot of blame on the script here from Phil Hay and Batman Freddy. It's a film that doesn't, I don't think it's self-aware enough to have any nuance to the film, and so you assume that everything it's doing is doing earnestly, and it just doesn't. It's one of those scripts where you feel like the writers think it's going to play better than it does. The dialogue is pretty uninspiring. It is very generic. And again, that's fine, but Aeon Flux is anything but generic by and large, so it doesn't seem terribly befitting of its material. And again, I'm a firm believer that a lot of issues you run into on a film can be avoided altogether with a good script. Even if it's not a good script, it can still be the right script, and I'm not sure that's what we have here.
No, that's fair. I mean, again, I'm willing to give a benefit of the doubt that while I don't think you can overcome the genericness with it, some of it would probably flow better in the original form that was intended, but that still doesn't overcome a number of the flaws that already exist in the material. With that here, in terms of a pit, I gotta give it to the editors on this film here, which includes Jeff Gullo, Peter Honus, and Plummy Tucker.
Plummy Tucker!
Now, I will put a caveat beside Tucker's name there, because from what I'm seeing in terms of the credits, that is Kusama's go-to editor. And from the sounds of it, they were fired alongside Kusama. And really, the bulk of the editing of this film went to Gullo and Honus, which doesn't surprise me. Again, taking a look at some of the credits, particularly of Gullo there, they've worked on a number of films overseen by Gale Ann Hurd as well, including Punisher 2004. And Honus is actually a respectable editor. They worked on L.A. Confidential and the original 1986 Highlander in this instance. But particularly the opening 15 minutes of this film is so clunky and so deeply flawed that, I mean, it takes a while for this film to find any sense of rhythm before it gets going. And that's a bit of a problem, particularly in a film that's not that terribly long with credits. So that they're definitely getting
my equipment. It runs a very brisk 90. But yeah, I mean, like, I guess the action scenes aim for that sense of rhythmic fluidity, and there is definitely like a parkour sort of influence here. And yet it stops while people just talk for such long amounts of time. And it doesn't really add up to anything, you know? I think some problems could also be solved with the edits here. And again, it's a testament to the fact that I don't think there's really a way you can make an invisibly edited version of this film the third time you're trying to put it together. But it does stumble in that regard.
Yeah. So any final, does anybody have any last pits in this instance?
For my last pit, I would just want to talk about the music from Graham Revel. I don't think Revel is necessarily like one of the elite composers, but you know, whenever I do see a score or hear a score of his, most of the time I generally do enjoy it. I'll say he's very good at that sort of generalized action-ish movie score. But this one I just found was just very forgettable because I can't even think of if there was any sort of just main motif or anything that represented anything in the film. And I think, that might have gone a little further, just in terms of memory, if there was just something to hold on to, even with the music, and there really wasn't that.
Yeah, no, I would definitely
Yeah,
second
it's kind
that.
of the signature, like this is the kind of film where action scene begins, hit score, like a very sort of EDM style influenced score. But there are also degrees of that, like this isn't the Chemical Brothers score for Hannah, right? Where, it does generate like that pulse and momentum. This is just, yeah, as you said, pretty forgettable. Like you can remember everything's like 160 BPM, but you can't remember what any of the music actually is.
Yeah. And again, I mean, with f fairness here, again, Kusama did not want the score. I forget who her original composer hired was, but apparently a whole score was written and then rejected by the studio for this. So, I mean, like, yeah, it's unfortunate here. I would be curious to hear what the original intentions were for this one as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a case where what we end up getting isn't what they set out to even do in the first place, but we can only look at the film that we're getting. And in this case, the film will soon to be forgetting. And not just because, as is our wont, we always have to watch another film. Hopefully, something a bit more dynamic. Maybe something a bit more cerebral, sophisticated, refined, something of endearing artistic quality. I'm thinking a Criterion movie maybe next. Dave, why don't you tell the good people at home what film we'll be looking at next episode and who we're going to follow to get there?
Well, yes, we are indeed getting a Criterion film, or a film that's in the Criterion Collection next. But this is also a film where, when I discovered this was on the Criterion Collection, even as a teenager, my first immediate question was, why? And that is, we're following Gale Ann Hurd to Michael Bay's 1998 classic Armageddon, starring, yes, Bruce Willis, Ben Affleck, Liv Tyler, Michael Clarke Duncan, Owen Wilson, and probably about half a dozen other people that I'm
Steve
forgetting.
Buscemi, Keith David, Billy Bob
Yeah.
Thornton, Ben
Right.
Affleck.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. Oh man,
So.
it's gonna be a great slice of real big budget spectacle sci-fi action cinema. So Eric, thank you for helping us try and pan whatever gold you can out of Eon Flux. Until you come and join us next time, where can people get in touch with you and check out what you're working on?
You can follow me on Twitter at Deacon05OC. And as always, I'm just on there mostly talking about movies. You can also check out some of my writing at my blog, which is deaconsden.wordpress.com. And now you can also check out some more writings of mine on Medium at Eric B. Jones 25. I've kind of recently just got started there, and I'm trying to keep a separate bit of writing between the blog and on Medium. So still learning the ins and outs of that one, but just trying to get more and more of my film writing out there.
Well, some people benefit from not being restrained by a character limit. Dave, you need to get in on Medium, and then we can monetize that, because 3 years in, we still don't know how to do it for our show. If you at home, though, know how to do that, where can they send their tips, Dave?
You can send tips to at 24 panels, but I gotta admit, I am busy as all hell right now with the day job, so I cannot promise that I will actually take up writing anything extensive anytime soon, in the immediate future here. But Andrew, if people want to encourage you to do that in this instance, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter with even less free time than David, at Filmstripper. You can also send whatever you want to the show email at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. Harvey S. in Connecticut, the answer is John Malkovich. John Malkovich and John Malkovich. As well, you can rate and review us on iTunes, Apple Music, whatever it's called these days. 5-star reviews help move us up the featured charts, get new listeners to our show. It's also where you can leave us a review. Let us know what do you like and what do you hate. We'll try not to do that going forward. Because across all these great many episodes, 400 years from now, I had a segue there. The important thing is that Dave and I only want to bring you a show that you want to listen to.
Indeed. So with that, do you have any parting words for our listeners, Andrew?
Why, yes, David, I do. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Now, there's a chance Pete Postlethwaite might actually save your DNA, but frankly, I wouldn't count on it. He doesn't think you have that much strength. Bye.
Destroy your DNA. I'd prefer not to.
Thank you.